This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
I'm Allie and I live in Southern California. I'm a huge fan of OTI. Their joyful outlook on sobriety is what finally inspired me to quit drinking. I've been a member since day one and I'm rapidly approaching 365 days alcohol-free, which is unreal. I love that Ben and Shaz are not just the podcast hosts. They also openly engage with members during the multiple weekly Zoom meetings and interact on the community member forum. You will not find a more supportive group of people. There's nothing like this in the United States. I'm beyond grateful to be a part of the Sober Rebellion.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Okay, I'm really excited. More excited than usually. Right. Breathe. It's like meeting a pop star. It really is. Honestly, this is where my life is at now. Okay, get it together. Welcome. Welcome to Over the Influence. We get so excited about our guests on the podcast, about the stories they share, and just everybody that comes on the pod. We get so excited. But today we are really, really excited. Hold that thought for just a minute while I quickly reintroduce ourselves. If you are just joining us for the first time, we're called Over the Influence. We sing about sobriety. I think I've just hit 3.5 years alcohol free. It's incredible. It will never not surprise me. I just got an actual thumbs up from Annie Grace. Anyway, like I said, hold that thought. Alcohol-free life, it's an absolute game changer. And the book we are going to talk about today is an absolute game changer. I'm not going to wang on during this introduction. I'm going to make it quite quick because we've got a lot to get through today. So my name's Shaz. Welcome to Over the Influence. I don't do this on my own. Hello to my 40-year-old co-host, Freddie.
Happy birthday,
Freddie.
Hello, Shazza. Hello, everybody. Yes, today I am 40 years old. Thank you to everyone for all your birthday wishes. What a wonderful way to spend my 40th birthday. I will say my 30th birthday looked a lot different. Literally, on this moment, 10 years ago, I was a relatively high-flying, stressed, heavy-drinking executive. I would have been getting the tequilas into the bar at this very moment. But then 10 years later, here I am on my 40th birthday in New Zealand, happier, healthier, over 1,000 days sober. And here I am speaking to our wonderful, iconic guest today. I cannot wait for this conversation. What a wonderful way to spend my 40th.
But you couldn't have imagined this, Freddie. If we'd have rewound a few years ago and said, guess who you'll be chatting to on your 40th birthday, you couldn't write it. Could you?
Absolutely couldn't. So yeah, it's going to be a great one. And yeah, the best is yet to come.
Fantastic. Freddie, thank you. And of course, we have got background Ben. We need to drop the background. He is no longer in the background. He is our producer. He's a very, very good podcast producer. Used to be.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I just thought I'd chuck that in there.
Cheers, Jess. You're a very good podcast presenter.
Thanks, love. When Ben joined us, he wasn't alcohol free. We didn't pick him out because of his lack of drinking skills or anything like that. We didn't care. He was just a brilliant podcast producer. But then something really strange happened. He spent a lot of time in our company, and the rest, as they say, is history. Hello, Ben.
Hello. Yeah, I'm not supposed to be here because I never intended to go alcohol free. I gave up booze 20 months ago now, and I've never felt better. I love alcohol free life. I love singing about it from the rooftops. My thing is, I'd love everybody to try it. Just anyone. It doesn't matter what your relationship is like with alcohol at the moment. If you've got that little voice in the back of your head, you're just kind of going, oh, you know what, mate? Like for me, I was turning to alcohol because I was stressed rather than it being fun anymore. And I had that little nagging voice going, this isn't good anymore. You're not going down a good path. I'm so glad I met you guys when I did, because I needed it. And I'm Shut up, Ben. Annie Grace is here. I'm alcohol-free and it's great. Okay. Over to you, Shaz.
Bursting to say that. We are really, really excited. Today's guest is very special. Means a lot to me, actually. I could probably hands down say that today's guest and your book completely changed my life. When you joined the Zoom call today, my face lit up with excitement, and it is like meeting a pop star. I feel a little bit starstruck. Annie Grace, author of This Naked Mind. Welcome to our podcast. This is amazing.
Well, this has been just the best welcome I've ever gotten my whole life. So thank you guys so much. I'm just grinning. This is such a fun group, and I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you so much. Absolutely brilliant. Where to start? I don't want to talk about myself, but I can't help it in just this little bit, Annie. When I first started to consider my relationship with alcohol and took a break, it's like the rules are, right, read this, do that, try this, listen to this, involve yourself in this. And I was like, right, there's this book, Annie Grace, This Naked Mind, buy it, get it, bedside table. And hands down, I swear, it changed my life. So from me to you, I can't believe I'm actually getting to say this in person. Thank you so much. Absolute game changer.
I'm so happy. That's so wonderful. Thank you for letting me know.
You're more than welcome. I'll stop fangirling now. I will try and sort of contain myself throughout the course of the podcast, because we are all really excited to have you here. Most people listening to this will either be alcohol-free, sober curious, maybe considering their relationship with alcohol in whatever way, shape or form. If they are one of the very few people that doesn't know who you are, Annie, would you mind just giving us a bit of an introduction? Who are you? Where are you from? What do you do?
Awesome. So my name is Annie. I am from the mountains in Colorado. I actually grew up in a tiny little one-room log cabin with no running water and no electricity, raised by hippie parents, like very much put the capital H in hippie, all things hippie. Therefore, they didn't drink a lot. So I didn't have a huge cautionary tale. Got into corporate, ended up working for a British company for over a decade, flying all around the world, found myself drinking 2 bottles of wine a night and really feeling like I had 2 options: to stop drinking and miss out on life, or to keep on drinking and deal with the consequences. And I lived there for far longer than I wish I would have, but all right in the end. And then did a bunch of research on my own, which really thoroughly changed my perspective on alcohol. Did not plan to quit my corporate job, just put that research out into the world. 20,000 people downloaded it within the first 2 weeks. And I started getting letters from people saying, hey, wow, this is what I needed to hear too. And you should make this a book. And I said, well, I don't know how to do that. But figured it out, self-published This Naked Mind in 2015. And since, it's just really been viral. It has, I think, just spread all over the place. And it's now close to 1 million copies sold and now traditionally published. I've written another book, and it's just been such a really, really cool whirlwind. Definitely an accidental author, accidentally in this story, but I'm very much enjoying it.
We love stories like this. It's incredible. Annie, I know Freddie and Ben both want to jump in. I just want to take you back to the woman that was sitting at home drinking 2 bottles of wine a night. I wasn't so far off that myself. I was about a bottle of wine a night. It crept up over the years, became a daily drinker. And like you, I just thought, there's got to be something else. There's got to be another way. Just take us back to that time and what life was like for you as a drinker.
Well, I mean, the things that stick out most prominently are, I think, the most deeply emotional things. You know, there was a time where my son, he was about 4 years old, and I asked him to sit on my lap, and he told me he didn't want to because I smelled funny and my teeth were purple. And quite frankly, I think I was scaring him. You know, there was another time where we were visiting the London Eye as a family, and I had 40 ounces of beer in my bag to kind of take the edge off what I'd done the night before. Went through the security, realized that I couldn't bring that onto the London Eye, so went to throw it away, ended up dropping that huge can of beer, spraying it all over my 2 young sons, and trying to laugh about it all the while inside, feeling like, oh, this is not the mom I intended to be. This is not truly, there's something out of alignment with who I know myself to be. And I can't, and by the way, an hour and a half after that, I sat down at the at lunch and ordered three drinks with my lunch. So there was nothing in those moments that really shifted. But the thing I remember most prominently is waking up at 3 a.m. and, you know, having just such certainty that today was going to be the day. Today was going to be the day where I wasn't going to overdo it. I was only going to have two glasses of wine. I was definitely, maybe I would even take a break. Maybe today would be a sober day. And then having all of these promises, all of this dialogue in my head with one narrative, which was, what's wrong with you? And how much is it going to take? How far are you going to have to fall before you do something about this? And then by 5 o'clock the very next day, pouring that drink without a care in the world and completely having dissociated from that person waking up in the middle of the night.
And I said that's an amazing story, Annie. I think it's certainly highlights how a lot of people have been on that journey. But we all get those warning signs. We all have those moments when we're like, yeah, maybe this, yeah. I always say, this isn't what normal people do. And thinking to ourselves, we're broken, we're not normal, there's something wrong with us, and all that negative self-talk. But looking back at your career, I mean, if I'm right, you around 26, you became the youngest vice president in your company's history. By 35 years old, you were in a senior management position in a global company.
Yep.
Clearly, you were doing lots of things right, and you were being highly successful at work, and then also at the same time trying to juggle it with your drinking. And did you ever have those moments when you thought, you know what, this is just what grown-up life is about? This is just the life of a high-flying executive, and sort of try and take yourself off the right path, if that makes sense.
I think that was most of my moments. I think most of my moments were looking around, either comparing myself to people who were certainly much worse than I was, or justifying this lifestyle because it was what everybody was doing. And I was legitimately told when I didn't drink all that much in corporate that I was missing out and that my career was going to be hurt if I didn't start showing up at happy hour. I had a boss take me aside and sort of let me know that happy hour was so much more than just getting drunk. It was really about connecting and, you know, stuff you didn't have time to do in the office, networking, politicking, all that sort of stuff. And so it gave me this whole perspective of like, okay, this is not only important for my career, it's vital. And so I think that I lived most of my thoughts in that, no, this is just how it is. And there were moments, though, little windows of time. 3 a.m. was one of those, but other windows of time where I would look around and say, wait, something is out of sync here. Something doesn't quite add up. Something doesn't quite make sense. And I think one of the most difficult things about that sort of life is that from the outside, people really do think you have it all together. I mean, even when I stopped drinking, I'd have people tell me, well, you weren't the one we were worried about. Why did you stop? You know, they had no idea what was happening sort of inside. And because we're all pretending to have it all together, nobody's talking about it. So it's not as if you can sit down, you know, over a cup of tea and be like, well, I feel like I'm, you know, eating a little too much sugar. And everybody's like, oh yeah, me too. Like, maybe we should blah, blah. Like that doesn't happen if you were to sit down with a colleague and say, yeah, I feel like I'm drinking a little too much Chardonnay. Everybody really panics for you. And are you okay? Are you getting help you need? Do you want us to not invite you? What do you need? How can I help? Like it's a very incendiary topic. And so you just tend to keep it all in. And so does everybody else. And so you're all kind of, most people, I would argue, are to some extent or another unhappy with how much they're drinking. There was actually a survey that was done, and it was almost 80% of regular drinkers wish they drank a bit less. But we're all just soldiering on. Nobody's dialoguing that, or at least they weren't when I was drinking in corporate.
Annie, where did you start? Because as you said, it's a self-published phenomenon. It says on the back of the book, of course it is. The front of the book is a big promise here: find freedom, discover happiness, and change your life. And it's a promise that we know that it is fulfilled. Jenny in the chat box, one of our community members who's watching, has just put in there, so many of us have read your book. It was the first book that I read after giving up, and it truly cemented my sobriety and gave me an enormous kick up my ass. I will be forever grateful. You did this for yourself, and you've impacted so many others. But where did you start? You know, you've got that thought in your head that you don't want to do this anymore. But in terms of the kind of research side, what was the first steps for you in putting this thing together.
Yeah, I think my path was pretty atypical because what I'd been trying to do was what most people try to do is try to create these rules and these promises. Okay, I'm just not going to have too many tomorrow, or I'm just going to take a few days off, or I would take a few days off, or I would get pregnant and then take 9 months off and then prove to myself, oh, I certainly don't have a problem now, right? So now everything is fine. And I was doing that, seeing the pain of drinking in the form of regretting what I did or said, or not having all the memories I wish I would have, or having the physical discomforts, and then saying, okay, well, then I'll just drink a bit less. But it wasn't successful. And over time, it is interesting. Something very unique happens in that moment of, okay, well, then I'll just drink a bit less. You go into it imagining that it's going to be easy. You walk through that door and it might be easy right at first, but then it gets more difficult. And, you know, you actually, in my experience, I created more noise in my mind, more fixation on an alcohol in the process of trying to not drink it, than there was when I was just kind of drinking whatever I wanted to. As soon as I started to try to control my drinking, as soon as I entered that phase of my life, which I would say probably was 5 or 6 years, if I look back in my journals and I sort of see when I started to think, oh, this isn't exactly, like, this is a problem, or I'm not really happy with how much I'm drinking anymore. In those 5 or 6 years, I thought about drinking, I obsessed about drinking, I was fixated on drinking or not drinking, more so than I ever was before I tried to control it. And the noise around it just escalated because my attempts at control were backfiring. They weren't working, or they certainly weren't working over the long term. And I created these two, this belief that, like, there was really these two options for me. Like, the one option was to keep drinking, and the other option was to not drink and just live this life of margin, feeling like I was missing out, feeling like I couldn't go to the, you know, the happy hours, or be part of the crowd, or even be part of my mommy wine groups or whatever, just feeling like I was going to have to live a slightly less good life, you know, that it wasn't going to be as fun. I wasn't going to be able to relax. I wasn't going to be able to connect with people as well. I wasn't going to be able to connect with my husband in the same way. I just felt like those are the two options: carry on drinking or live this life where I'm deprived and missing out. And I think that's what most of us see. We see these two options kind of stretching off into the abyss, and they both sound pretty terrible, to be honest with you. And so for me, the really differentiating moment, I was coming back from the UK. I was in the bowels of Heathrow Airport. I'd just gotten off the Heathrow Express, and I was super drunk at 6 in the morning because I'd had a really light boozy night the night before. Then I'd gone to the hotel bar. I'd had 3 more drinks at the hotel bar. And I'm just thinking, all I need to do is to be able to get myself on the plane so that I can just pass out, get myself home to my family. That's all I need to do. And I remember sitting there and feeling hungover, drunk, and, you know, that just place of just weeping and crying and journaling and writing, like, just the same words of, what is my problem? And am I an alcoholic? What is wrong with me? And in what I can only describe as, like, a really watershed, pivotal moment that definitely didn't feel like it came from inside me, but almost felt like it came from outside of me, I started asking a new question. And that question was, well, why? Why did I used to be able to take it or leave it? Why was I not fixated on alcohol before I ever drank it? Why do some people have a drink and then not have 5 more or 10 more drinks? Like, why is this happening? Why am I smart and in control in every other area of my life, but this is the strange exception? Like, what is happening? And so in that moment, I realized, wow, there's power in asking a different question. But I also somehow had the presence of mind to realize that the noise that I had created around trying to drink less was so loud that I didn't think I could uncover the answer. I literally thought that there was too much drama, noise, self-loathing, self-hatred, self-doubt to even have the presence of mind to uncover the answer. And so I said, you know what I'm going to do? And I wrote it down in my journal. I said, no matter what happens, no matter where this goes, I'm going to forget trying to control my drinking. I'm going to stop trying to stop. And I'm going to find out why. I'm going to give myself a year. I don't even think it really took a year. I need to go back. I actually just had an interview with a major news publication. They were asking me for specific dates. I'm like, I really need to go back and create, like, a timeline, because I have it all written down in journals. But I said, I'm gonna stop trying to stop. I'm gonna, I have to take the noise away. Like, I have to create enough space in my mind that I can learn something new. And I went through and I made a list of every single reason I drank. And I asked my friends every single reason they drank. And I just started methodically going through. And we live in this beautiful day and age where you can go onto Google Scholar. You can be any old person. You don't have to be a PhD. And you can download scientific studies, $50, $100, pay for the study, read it yourself, digest the information. And I just accumulated all of that information in this huge growing document. I was showing my husband the original journals the other day, and they are like this thick of typewritten pages. It's probably 300,000-400,000 words. And by the end of this research process, something miraculous had happened. And I say it's miraculous because I still feel the miracle of it to this day, where with new knowledge, I suddenly felt something new. My desire for the drink changed. It is really hard to look at a glass of wine and say, this is going to relax me, when you know beyond a shadow of a doubt from five different versions of a study, or, you know, all of these ways that your brain works neurochemically, that like it is going to do the opposite. And within 20 minutes, you're going to feel worse than you feel before your first sip. Like, when you know that and you're so certain of it scientifically, and then I try it on myself because I was still drinking. And I think that was such a gift to myself, because I'd be like, okay, well, is that really true? And so I'd have a drink and I'd wait 20 minutes. And sure enough, I would feel worse than before I picked up that first sip. And so I'd feel totally compelled to have that next drink. And then I'd time it, it would be 18 minutes. And then I'd feel worse than even before that first drink. And it was like this thing, right? Where I started to notice things like, wow, I feel better when I reach for the bottle of wine to pour it before I even took one sip of it. That's when I start to feel relief. What does that mean? Certainly not the wine. What else is happening? What are these triggers? What are these patterned responses? And like, I'm a nerd. I went so deep into the science. It is the biggest criticism I sometimes get when I'm being interviewed, is people are like, you need to make this simpler because it's really difficult to understand. But I just, when I learned all of those new things, I felt something new. And one of my favorite things to say, and I know it's so hard for people to believe who are still drinking, but without desire, there is no temptation. You do not want something you believe. You have to believe it provides a benefit to want it. You do not want something you don't believe provides a benefit. And so if there's lingering desire, there's lingering belief there. Even if it's not conscious, there's a belief that that substance provides a benefit. And I think that those beliefs can be at all sort of different. I mean, it can be about the alcohol itself. It can be about society. It can be about yourself. You can be drinking to self-medicate. So there's lots of layers. But at the end of the day, that was my journey. And so I just stopped. I told my husband, if you want to drink with me again, tonight's the night, because I think I'm going to not drink anymore after this. I didn't have any declaration of, you know, counting days or time. I actually had to look up what date that was recently for another interview. It was December 15th, 2014. I know that now, but I didn't know it at the time. And because I just was so, it was just, why would I think about it? I just don't want to do that anymore. I'm not going to spend. So instead of being fixated on it, where it took up so much of my mind, I was like totally liberated. Like there was no mental real estate being focused on alcohol anymore.
I love that, Annie. I think it, on behalf of all of us, we love the science and we love the detail. And also I love the fact that only 20 minutes in that you naturally assume that Over the Influence is full of highbrow, intelligent, academic people. Well, such as us.
Yeah, I was going to say, Annie, so you've been interviewed by both a major news publication and Over the Influence all in the same week. What a week you're
amazing.
Having.
It's amazing.
Amazing. I mean... Dreams do come true. On a more serious note, that you're totally right, Annie. And I've had this similar conversation with myself. I mean, I always say I tried and failed to change my drinking habits 1,000 times over 10 years. Why did I fail 1,000 times? And then just one time it clicked and I never looked back. And I always say we always just need to get it right once and mm-hmm. then we win. But I think so many people... And I was in this position. You'd wake up on a Sunday morning, hungover. I'm never doing that again. I'm going to change my ways. I'm going to change my habits. But then on the Friday evening, you're in the same bar with the same people doing the same thing, and you're there going, oh, I'm not going to drink, guys. But you already know deep down that that's that you're telling a lie to yourself. And I think, as you say, if we can create that space to really understand why we do something, and again, look at it objectively and think, well, is it the alcohol that's making me feel great? Or is it actually because I'm here with my friends and it's a sunny day and there's my favourite song playing and all these wonderful things? And my, I do have a question, believe it or not. And my question is, how, if someone's in that position and they're saying, I don't want to have yet another day one, I don't want to break this promise to myself, and I want this to be the last time, what do you think the first thing is that they should do? Is it writing down all those reasons why they think they drink, or is there something else as well?
I think that if I had to go back and say, you know, what was it that made it so so successful for myself, and now a lot of other people have been able to follow that method, I would say the first step was curiosity without judgment. And really getting curious about why I was doing what I was doing, but putting down the judging myself for doing it. And it sounds so easy, but it is not easy. It is really hard because it is ingrained in us so deeply that if you want to change your behavior, the path to changing your behavior is by beating yourself up, showing yourself how bad it is, continuing to harp on yourself. Like it's literally like, that's how we change. Like I thought, well, if I don't do things like that with my eating or my drinking or exercise, I'm just going to end up, you know, on the couch forever watching TV, just eating ice cream constantly. Like that's what the end result of me not trying to beat myself up will be. But the truth is not that, because there's only so much ice cream and cookie dough you want to eat before you're like, wait, this isn't fun. I actually don't want to do this. And so I think that being able to put down the judgment and just realize like, hey, you know what? You are literally doing the best you can with the tools you have. And our global society has given us the wrong tools to handle adult life. And one of the main tools they've handed to us is alcohol. And so you just have to understand, like, you are doing the best you can. This messaging is coming to you from every single direction. Chances are it came from your parents and from your society and from your colleagues. And so we got to just put down the judgment. And when we put down the judgment, we can awaken that space of, okay, well, why then am I doing this? Does it actually make me feel better? We're not willing to ask those questions when those questions are just laden with, oh, well, you shouldn't have, I can't believe you did. What's wrong with you? Are you going to blah, blah, blah? And I'd say the other key factor there is that I actually changed the goalposts. So my goal had been to drink less or drink nothing. It had been what I would call a behavior-based goal. It was completely and totally tied into what I did, right? And the thing was, is that I would sometimes be successful. I would be able to go for 3 months, 9 months, a week without drinking, but I always felt like crap. And so when I changed the goalpost and said, okay, forget the behavior for a second. Let's just wait. Forget the behavior. How do I want to feel? When I made that shift, everything changed for me, because guess what? Like, I wasn't going to stop in my quest, no matter how many day ones or whatever you want to call it I had, until I felt that certain way. And if you think of it for yourself right now, like, just think of, okay, a behavior that you want to do. Maybe you want to journal more, or maybe you want to meditate more. And you think just purely on the behavior. Okay, I want to meditate more. Like, do you get any juice from that? Like, are you really motivated? Like, wow, I just can't wait to do that behavior. Probably not. But if you think, okay, I want to have much more clarity of mind. I want to feel clearer every day. I want to be more peaceful in my mind. And if I achieve that through meditation or through exercise or through journaling or through going on a walk, all of those things are available for me to try out. But just that goal of I want more clarity, like, that gives us juice. We can see that. We can feel that. We're motivated toward that. And so I think this idea that we should be focused so intensely on our behavior actually can lead us astray, because as soon as I said, you know what, and my goal was that I wanted alcohol to be small and irrelevant, because I saw that even drinking, I was so fixated on it. I was thinking about it more when I was not drinking than when I was drinking. So I had actually achieved my behavior-based goal and literally made myself more miserable. And when I could see that clearly, and I said, you know what? I want alcohol to be small and irrelevant. If that means that I do all this research and I find out, no, it's the end all be all. It is for sure the thing. They should have just given it to us in the hospital, bottle of vodka instead of formula, because we human beings, dang it, we need alcohol. If I would have thought, you know, that, and that's what my research would have proven to me, then you would be seeing me probably starting a spirit company. But that's not what the research showed me. The research showed me that, you know, like, there's not a lot in here that is beneficial. And so through that, I never stopped with any day ones, because A, I stopped beating myself up, and B, my goal now was how I wanted to feel. And when my goal is how I wanted to feel, I was willing to try on. Maybe that means I moderate. Maybe that means I never drink again. I actually am okay with whatever behavior that feeling needs to achieve. So for me, that means I don't drink anymore, because that's what it means to make alcohol small and irrelevant. But I didn't jump into this, that from that point in Heathrow Airport, I did not jump into that conversation to convince myself to never drink again. I jumped into it with curiosity, without judgment, and with an emotion-based goal of how I wanted to feel. And I think those three things really brought me to where I am today.
Can I ask you a personal question, Annie? How old were you when you stopped drinking?
Oh, I'm so bad with the numbers. Okay, so I'm 43 now, and it's 2022, and it was in 2014. So what does that
mean? Oh, I'm awful. Come on, Ben. Ben, get out your couch. Ben's the numbers man. 8 years,
36.
36.
That's really interesting. So similar, same sort of age as Freddie when Freddie stopped.
Yeah, I was 37, I think, yeah.
Yeah. The reason I want to ask you, I am a little bit older than you. So I stopped when I was, oh God, Ben, 43?
What's the numbers? How long, so 3 years you've been alcohol-free for, haven't you?
Three
how
and
old
half,
are you now?
Actually.
She'd never 48. Ask a lady that.
48.
Yes, yeah, 44, 45.
Ish. Annie, everything you were talking about there and all these incidents and the things you've learned and the research, everything to bring you to that point where you said, that's it, I'm not going to drink anymore. My God, it can take years, can't it? It can take so long to get that to that point. Like I said, I was 43, 44. I think late 30s, I started to go, maybe I should have a break then. Maybe should have a break there, maybe should do that. And that, as you said, that noise that you start to create in your head, oh my God. I mean, now you don't have that noise. It's utterly liberating. I've never experienced a freedom like it. Well, it's Ali that mentioned here, Ali, who's also in the States. It says it took me 5 years to actually quit. And you've got so much unlearning to do from society, from growing up, from being a teenager, from the workplace, from all these, everything you're surrounded with. And I think the point I'm trying to get to is that it takes the patience of a saint, doesn't it? And you really do have to just be prepared to put the work in, and you get there eventually. But when that penny drops, it's utterly glorious and life-changing. But it takes a hell of a time to get there, or at least it can do for many people. I'm just speaking from bitter experience.
And I think one of the ways to make that time frame shorter is that idea of curiosity without judgment. Because when you judge yourself and you have a drink, then you're not going into it and you're not getting curious about, well, what was the underlying belief or desire that led me to drink that in the first place, right? And so you're just saying, okay, well, I mean, I remember for me before that moment, so I really have a pre that moment. I didn't stop drinking that moment. Remember, I actually stopped trying to stop drinking, but I had a pre, and it was definitely 5-6 years. I mean, I think my first journal entries about drinking too much were my late 20s. And then in that instance, every time I'd overdo it, there was so much pain and shame and guilt that I didn't actually want to explore why I was doing it in the first place. I wanted to run away from that. And guess where I ran? Right back into the bottle, because that's how we drinkers realize, have been conditioned to believe stress is alleviated, right? And so it just created this cycle. And I think the way to interrupt that cycle is with the curiosity without judgment. I actually see that there's a really good question from really on this topic from Susan, which, you know, she says, has that ever wavered since you know, the 15th of December? And do I ever still have cravings? And the thing is, so the premise is like, without desire, there's no temptation, right? And in order to get to that point, you need to uncover all the false beliefs you have about alcohol and decouple all of the things that you have tied alcohol to. So I had tied alcohol to, oh my gosh, every single sporting event, every single date night, every single happy hour, baby showers, funerals. I mean, you name it, alcohol was there, present, Tuesday night, doesn't matter. It was there, right? And so when I stopped, there was still decoupling work to do. And every first presented a new belief set that I didn't know was there, right? So for example, the first time I flew internationally where the booze is free, I was really triggered and I had to sit there and but I had a skill set now, which was curiosity without judgment. I knew I wasn't going to drink because I was like, I don't see a benefit, but I'm very curious. Why do I want to drink right now on this airplane when I haven't even wanted one like 4 months by that point in time, right? And I was like, what is it that's different? Like I walk by the liquor store. My husband drinks in my house. I've not wanted a glass of wine, but right now, right here, I want a glass of wine. And when I really got curious about it, whipped out my little journal, the truth was that there is something very tied into scarcity for me and something being free. I grew up without a lot of money with definitely, okay, I grew up in the richest zip code in the USA in a tiny little cabin by hippies who had sworn off wealth. It was a very privileged experience in a way because it was all by choice. Equally though, for a kid who doesn't understand that, like there was a lot of scarcity for me. And so the idea of turning down something that was free was a huge trigger, but I had to experience that to realize that. And guess what? That, because I solved it, never triggered me again. And there was firsts all throughout. The first time I went on a all-inclusive vacation, you know, the first time I went to Brazil, you know, because I'd been, oh, I'm going to try the Cipriano's and we're going to go out salsa dancing, which we still did. I just had virgin drinks. But, you know, the first, all of these firsts presented a coupling that I had to unwind. And it couldn't get unwound before that because I'd never done it for the first time.
But Annie, you'd not tied yourself to these, you know, date night equals booze, Christmas equals booze. Society has tied you to
that. That's a good point.
And, and this is a huge, huge question. And it's one that nobody can probably ever answer. But you know what, Annie? It's Annie Grace. And if I'm going to ask this question to anybody, you're probably the best person to ask it to.
Pressure.
Why? Why are we marketed alcohol at every turn? Why does the advertising guy have an old fashioned? Why does the glamorous Hollywood heroine stand there with a glass of champagne? What is it about society? Why is alcohol pushed at us from every direction? Is it money? Is it money for the alcohol companies? Is it because of the tax revenue that governments get? Is it medication? Is it self-medication? Is it kind of dull the senses of society? Is it something that we've just, as a group, collectively decided to kind of turn a blind eye to all the negatives because actually we quite like the feeling of being pissed? Why? Like, why is it such a big thing in society? Why has society tied our thoughts to birthdays, funerals? Why, Annie Grace? Why? Why?
All right. So I have a few different thoughts on this. I will not claim to have all the answers. But I think, you know, if we just want to tackle the financial aspect first, nothing is taxed as high as alcohol. It's taxed and cigarettes. I mean, the addictive substances, we've put a premium tax on them in order to discourage people from buying that. But that has encouraged our governments to allow anything because of the tax revenue is monumental. And if you imagine from just a purely business point of view, almost every restaurant you know of would have a very hard time staying in business for the exact same reason, because the profit margin on alcohol is so much higher than the profit margin on food. And you can just, you know, like consume it. So without the drinks, those businesses would have a hard time. So there's a lot of collective incentive for us, because we want to get together. We want to socialize. We are a, you know, group, tribal almost species. We enjoy each other's company. Those things don't have to be infused with alcohol, but in a commercial perspective, when they are, you know, there's a lot of money to be made. I think though, beyond that, what's really interesting is that, you know, there was a study done where if mice were offered water and alcohol, they turned their noses up at alcohol because instinctually they said, no, that's poison. Now, once they were force-fed an addictive substance, they would do radical things like burn themselves in order to get at that substance in order to give themselves more of it. But they had to become addicted. So to think that there is not a pattern in our brain from everything, from high fructose corn syrup to video games to Instagram to heroin to alcohol, that creates neurochemical addiction is just not true. Now, where we've really, I, in my opinion, got it very wrong is to say that that with alcohol is only assigned to a small fraction of the population we call, quote, alcoholics. Now, there's nothing medically or scientifically to back that up whatsoever. But what that does, from again, a marketing perspective, is it says, well, guess what? If you're not one of those people, and by the way, if you are, geez, I'm really sorry. That sucks for you. But as long as you're not one of those people, then don't worry about how much you're drinking because you can't get addictive. I would say majority of people do not realize that alcohol is addictive to human beings with brains and cells and organs, not just alcoholics. I think people still have this false belief that alcohol is only addictive to a certain percentage of the population. And then that belief can be reinforced. Well, why can my Aunt Sherry just drink on occasion? Why does so-and-so not fall into the trap so soon? And there's so much science and so many reasons behind that that we probably don't have time to get into, but just suffice it to say that I promise you, every doctor will agree with you. Every scientist will agree with you. Alcohol is addictive to human beings. That fact is obscured. In America, we actually have on our bottles, instead of any sort of disclaimer about harm, we have the phrase drink responsibly. It is the most shame-inducing phrase, I think, that's ever been created because of how it's used. It's used to say, hey, human being, if you can't drink this addictive liquid responsibly that will chemically alter your brain to make you want more of it, something is wrong with you. And you better not talk about it to anybody else because, man, they'll all think something is wrong with you. So let's just hide this and let's be really ashamed about it. Let's never talk about it because collectively you're irresponsible if you happen to get addicted to an addictive substance. And I think it's just egregious. Like I'm not in favor of prohibition or banning stuff because I think humans value freedom above almost anything else. And I think that just creates a lot of drama, but I am certainly in favor of us at least labeling things in a more thoughtful way that gives some, you know, removes the shame. I read a statistic recently that if Americans did indeed drink responsibly within America, that is 8 drinks a week for women, 15 for men, if we did indeed drink responsibly, the alcohol sales would drop by 80% tomorrow, which would mean that most alcohol companies would go out of business. So it is a machine. There's a lot of lobbyists and a lot of people with a lot of interest in keeping this machine going. I tend to not buy into like there's a them and they're all in a room and they're trying to like, you know, control the narrative. But I do think that there is a lot of individual decisions that have been made over time that just have become easier and easier to make because, you know.
Holy shit, Annie. That was awesome. I feel so fired up. Like, in the chat box. Go, Annie, says
so
Susan.
Yes,
Ali, so much yes. Yeah. Yep. You know what, though, Annie? Sorry, Freddie and Shaz. I know that I've been talking loads and I will shut up
back.
In a second.
Crack
but
on.
This week, we've seen the CEO, Philip Morris, the cigarette company, say that within 10 years, you know, they want to move it more towards the kind of vape-based products and everything else. And look, there's a whole debate about that and the health and whatever else. But you never would have thought you would have heard someone in that position say those words. So it does feel like society is changing, but it does feel like alcohol is just a bit behind. And I think, you know, we're all there flying the flag, saying how much better life is and everything else, but it's still a bit of a way to go, isn't there?
I think it was Mark Twain that said this, that if you find yourself on the side of the majority, then you really need to question your beliefs. Because the minority is almost always correct, because the minority is willing to undergo the discomfort of going against the majority. And so, although we are a minority, every movement in the world has started with a minority, has started with just a few people who say, I want something better than this for myself and my kids and my family and for the world. And I think that the evidence that we are a minority, I think, according to Mark Twain, proves that we are like, We're right.
You're going to set Freddie off now. I can feel it, Freddie. Here we go.
Right, I'll get warmed up for this one. I totally agree, Annie. And one thing I say is a lot of us, not all of us, but a lot of us started drinking because we felt like rebels, because we were teenagers, yep, and we wanted to, you know, steal something from the parents' drinks cabinet or try and be served alcohol when we were underage or all these things. We had this fun feeling that we were doing something naughty and that we were rebelling against our parents and society and those people that made the laws and everything else. And then as we, you know, become parents and obviously you've probably noticed I'm not a woman, but you know, there's this whole, you know, the whole mummy drinking culture of let's have a naughty glass of wine, we're going for lunch but let's have a naughty gin and tonic, and this thought pattern that we can tell ourselves all the way through that we're being naughty or we're being rebels or we're going against the system. And I think, and because many people label themselves as the all or nothing type or the rebel or the people without an off switch, like if we're going to start a rebellion now, then let's make it a sober rebellion, because we can be the revolution and we are that small crowd, but we can go against the majority. I think what you're saying is absolutely right, that we can make a stand and this, we can fly the flag. And this is what you're doing so well with your podcast and your books and your whole business. It's saying to people, look, we know how you're feeling, but this is where you belong. This is where you can make things happen. And this is where you can make a stand. And I believe that with people such as yourself and with all of us coming together in this movement, then we can, I was going to say, take down the big bad corporations, but we can help people to understand that there is another way. There is a way that we can all live our lives and make a difference and fulfill our potential, which I believe that it's all about, is helping people to live a life without regret and fulfill their potential. And I will say as well, and because I'm aware of time, but again, turning 40, everything about, like, it seems to be wine as a man in your 40s, it's aged like a fine wine, and everyone's like, oh, you should be doing a vineyard tour and you should be doing this and it's going to be an all-day drinking session for you. And I, again, like you on the plane, I was there thinking, maybe, because I like to celebrate, maybe I could just have one. Obviously I didn't, because that would be a terrible podcast today if I was hungover, but I think we all have these different things around us. I don't really have a question. I'll just go off on a rant because Shazza set me up for it so nicely. But it's to say, yes, I agree with everything you say, Annie. I think that's why your voice in this whole world, in this whole community is so, so powerful. So thank you. This is the best birthday present ever, by the way, to have this conversation with you.
This is such a fun conversation.
Really is, yeah.
I also think that one of your points was so well made, and it's great if we can change policy, right? It's great if we can change labeling. But the truth is that we all have the power right now just to vote with our dollars.
Annie, that has absolutely flown, and it has been everything I hoped this episode would be and more with knobs on. It's been superb. As I mentioned at the start of this podcast, your book changed my life. It's brilliant. So thank you so much. And I know Ben and Freddie were so excited. We'll be saying, guess who we've got on the pod? It's been brilliant. We've not been able to contain our excitement. Thank you so much for speaking to us so honestly and so openly and inspiring our community members, not only who are watching this recording, but who tune into the pod every single week. From all of us, thank you so much. If somebody, by some strange reason or other, doesn't know what your book is called or where they can find it, just remind people, Annie.
Awesome. It's called This Naked Mind. And there's also a 30-day alcohol experiment, which is always free at alcoholicexperiment.com. So it's just 30 days of videos to, you know, dip a toe and create your own hypothesis about how life might be just drinking a bit less. Again, it's always free. And then, of course, the podcast is This Naked Mind Podcast. So thank you, guys. It's just been an honor. It's really fun. You guys have a good time, and I enjoy being part of it.